Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So I really like this topic, and I actually should thank you for choosing it because I hadn't written this talk yet. So this will be the, you know, so there'll be probably some bugs and kinks and that sort of thing. But it's a great exercise type topic where you really can just get your mind thinking through logical distinctions and also to grasp just a few fundamental principles that might not be familiar to us, especially when it comes to property and the relationship between natural law and human law. So the talk is organized with the handout here in these four sections. An introduction here, what's our question? Then I'm going to present an objection. So to someone who rejects the position that Aquinas is going to take, a response, and then what does Aquinas say on that? So we'll go through these quotes in each of those sections. So introduction then. Is stealing an intrinsic moral evil? It'd be helpful to begin with two familiar examples. Jean Valjean stealing a loaf of bread in order to feed his sister's starving children from Les Miserables and being sentenced to prison as a result. And two questions here. First, was this act morally wrong? And second, should he have been punished for the act? So should it be also against the law? As we will see, one could answer the first question with yes, the second with no, or the first with no and the second with yes. So we need to make a distinction between the moral act and then the legal issue of what should we do with certain actions in response to them as a community. Second, Robin Hood and his band of merry men robbing the rich in order to help the poor. In this case, we go beyond the single act of taking possessions from somebody to save one's own life or that of another, and envision vigilante justice on behalf of the poor. Could that be morally justified? Now, if in both of these cases you have no sympathy for the claim that stealing could ever be morally justified, let me provide a hypothetical, a local one. A woman is returning to Atlanta from a visit to her mother in Milledgeville. Do we know where Milledgeville is? Used to be state capital. Her car breaks down on a lonely country road in Jones County. Anyone here know where Jones County is? Oh, great. This is great. So on the way back from Milledgeville, in a state of near starvation, on the side of the road, she picks up and eats a few pecans fallen from a farmer's trees. If you think even this is morally wrong, I would suppose you must think there are no exceptions to it. So let's look at the first two quotes on the handout, and it does indeed look like you would be right to deny any exceptions to the moral principle, thou shalt not steal. The following are from St. John Paul II's landmark 1993 encyclical, Veritatis Splendor. And this first quote, yeah, it is one that has this, it is not this, it's a little bit hard to follow. You got to keep the knots in mind here. So let's read it, and then we'll try to explain it. One must therefore reject the thesis, characteristic of teleological and proportionalist theories, which holds that, and this is being rejected, it is impossible to qualify as morally evil according to its species, its object, the deliberate choice of certain kinds of behavior or specific acts, apart from a consideration of the intention for which the choice is made or the totality of the foreseeable consequences of that act for all persons concerned. And then he goes on to say, in quote B there, Jesus himself reaffirms that these prohibitions allow no exceptions. If you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. We're not interested tonight in getting into the moral theologies that JP II was rejecting, or in reviewing the reasons people were concerned that Pope Francis was opening the door to these moral theologies rejected by JP II. But we do want to note that the Thomist is on the side of St. John Paul II and the constant teaching of the Church that there are moral absolutes. All of that quote was to say is there are moral absolutes, whatever the circumstance, whatever the tension, intention, they cannot be done. There are actions that are always morally right, loving God and neighbor as self, actions that are always morally wrong, stealing, and actions that are, in the abstract, morally indifferent, skipping stones on a pond being an example. By contrast, utilitarians, consequentialists, proportionalists, and surely other moral thinkers, argue that no action in itself is morally evil, but only tends to be in most circumstances, and could be morally good in extreme situations. These often come up to in analysis of war as well, that people will argue that, well, in this extreme case, the moral rules don't apply. These false theories fail to make the distinction between the moral object of an action, the circumstances in which it takes place, and the intention of the agent. No matter what the circumstances or intention of the agent, if the moral object is evil, so is the action. So put simply, good ends cannot justify evil means. If stealing is intrinsically evil in its moral object, and it does look to be the case, that's what it says on the quote there, it is always morally wrong, no exceptions. As a matter of fact, Aquinas often uses stealing as his example when he's explaining moral action, as an action that has an evil moral object and so cannot ever be done. It would seem then that we have a clear answer to our question, were it not for a puzzling claim Aquinas makes in his discussion of the vices relative to justice. It's question 66 of the Secunda Secundae on theft and robbery. So we're going to proceed again to an objection to the claim that stealing is always morally wrong. It would appear that both my example of the woman returning home to Atlanta, as well as Jean Valjean, can be morally justified, and we'll return to Robin Hood later. So again, as I said, we're going to proceed in the disputed question format that you hopefully know from reading Aquinas, beginning with the objection to the position on the table, a response to it, and then an I answer that section. So now section 2 here in the handout, objection. Stealing seems to be permitted in the case of manifest and urgent need. First, in defense of the woman returning home to Atlanta, long quote here, but it's worth reading in full because there's a lot of different points we need to go over. I answer that things which are of human right cannot derogate from natural right or divine right. Now, the division and appropriation of things which are based on human law do not preclude the fact that man's needs have to be remedied by means of these very things. Hence, whatever certain people have in superabundance is due by natural law to the purpose of succoring the poor. For this reason, Ambrose says, it is the hungry man's bread that you withhold, the naked man's cloak that you store away, the money that you bury in the earth is the price of the poor man's ransom and freedom. Since, however, there are many who are in need, while it is impossible for all to be succored by means of the same thing, each one is entrusted with the stewardship of his own things, so that out of them he may come to the aid of those who are in need. Nevertheless, and here's the qualification, if the need be so manifest and urgent that it is evident that the present need must be remedied by whatever means be at hand, then it is lawful for a man to succor his own need by means of another's property by taking it either openly or secretly. Nor is this, properly speaking, theft or robbery. Let's focus on the moral issue here, and again, political part we'll get to later. We're not asking whether or not taking someone's property without consent should ever be legal. That's a different question. What we're asking is, could it ever be moral? When we do turn to the political issues, again, Robin Hood. We don't want to forget the Robin Hood part. Does Aquinas in this passage show support for a broader rob from the rich and give to the poor philosophy? In this first case, Aquinas defends the woman returning home to Atlanta. I think this is as clear as it can be, that that's what the sort of thing he has in mind. The principle he establishes is that in the case of three different points here. First, urgent and manifest need such that it is evident one must take from another. Second, when there is another who has a superabundance of goods. And then third, one may openly or secretly, by whatever means be at hand, take the property necessary to provide for one's own need. All right, let's treat those three in order. First, we're clearly not talking about it'd just be really nice to have that thing that you have that I would like to have. We're also not talking about that I'm in need and I don't want to make the effort to reach out for help from someone in the community. We are really talking about a case where there's no other way to gain assistance. We can make an analogy to war with the last resort clause, which is one of the clauses often used in just war theory, that we need to exhaust every other option. But thinking about that war analogy a little bit, consider the restrictions that have been placed on preemptive strikes. So preemptive strikes kind of seem like a similar thing where normally I can't attack you unless you've done something, but there could be exceptions to it. And this seems to be, I can take something of yours. So let's think of how narrow or how broad does urgent and manifest mean. The Caroline test was formulated by Daniel Webster in response to an incident in the 1837 Upper Canada Rebellion. A British-Canadian militia unit entered U.S. territory and destroyed the U.S. civilian steamer Caroline because it was being used to support Canadian rebels. In Webster's critique of the Canadian government's actions, he argued that a preemptive strike is only justified in a situation that is, quote, so think about the urgent manifest case of taking, instant, overwhelming, and leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberations. Literally, she will die if she doesn't get some sustenance. This has been upheld as the standard in international law, but the Bush administration in 2002 broadened it to, quote, grave and gathering danger, which is a little less strict. So how strict, how broad should this case be? Okay, the second thing, superabundance. That's not a household word. What does superabundance mean? It's not entirely clear. Why doesn't he just say abundance if someone has abundance? Why this term? Consider, for example, the parable of the widow's offering in the Gospels of Mark and Luke. This poor woman is praised for giving out of her property her whole living. By contrast, the rich only contributed out of their abundance, and they aren't praised. Why insist on superabundance and not just abundance? Why does this person have more than that? Or does Aquinas not mean it's not a strict term? Three considerations here. In defense of, I do think he means that term as more than simply abundance. First, God intends for us to have abundance so that we can be fruitful and multiply, enjoy the Sabbath rest, devote time for prayer and worship, and for things like TI lectures. These require that we have more than mere subsistence. Some people have to study very hard for something tomorrow. They don't have time to come and think on things like this. On the other hand, having too many surplus goods or superabundance is harmful to us. Like, as St. Ambrose puts it, waters that overflow their banks, or as John Ruskin puts it, a museum with so many knickknacks that we become tired when trying to take them all in. You ever had that kind of experience? Or I have too much time on my hands and I become bored and I lose any kind of motivation to do anything. Superabundance is, in this sense, another term for decadence, too much of a good thing. In De Regno, Aquinas makes the interesting observation that while a city should have delightful things and beautiful vistas, it should not abound in superfluous delights. Why not? Because this can lead citizens to think of pleasure rather than virtue as the measure of their city's goodness. One thinks, for example, of San Francisco as superabundant. Too many beautiful vistas and too many delightful things. Whereas Pittsburgh, and maybe Atlanta, that's abundant. You know, it's nice looking, but it's not. So Atlantans and Pittsburghers should be more virtuous and less decadent than San Franciscans. I don't know if we maybe do a study on that, but it's a great point, right? Is that you can imagine it's so beautiful here. You're not motivated to work and to build up things. Okay, so second on superabundance, another reason to defend that this is a technical term. While possessing a superabundance of material goods is bad for us, an abundance of them is generally necessary for virtuous living. The wealthy are not vicious for only giving of their abundance, but they do not achieve the level of perfection of the widow. In short, what we have in the case of the widow Jesus praises is an example of the apostolic counsels. Those who take vows of poverty as monks, friars, or nuns give away all the material possessions, but we do not think that priests or lay people who give only of their abundance thereby commit sin. Third and finally, let us distinguish between how much we ought to give to others and how much they can take from us in times of need. It is one thing to say that if I run into a homeless man on my way to the talk, I ought to give him the money I had planned on donating to the Mystic Institute so that college students could attend lectures. It's quite another to say that this man could rightfully take it from me without my permission. I think Aquinas chooses his words carefully here and wants to convey that taking in the case of need requires the legitimate owner having so much that there is no danger that the taking will deny him of what he needs. So a couple chickens in the yard doesn't really count, right? That the pecan example is great for that. There's so many, right? Third and finally, I take it that it is obvious from what has been said that the woman on her way home from Atlanta, assuming the owner is not around, may eat the pecans. Well, it may not be clear if this constitutes open or secret taking, since she makes no effort to hide what she is doing. We could distinguish this from a case in which the property in question is in view of the owner. The owner is actually in the grove. The fact that Aquinas condones open taking and using, quote, whatever means be at hand, makes us wish he would have answered another question. Would one be justified in using or threatening violence against the property owner if he refuses to come to one's aid in this circumstance? The fact that Aquinas concludes his response by referencing both theft and robbery would suggest that the answer is yes, because in a previous article, he had clarified the difference between theft and robbery is that in the case of robbery, you use violence, whereas in the case of theft, it's the owner is ignorant of what you're doing. But on the other hand, in the following article, he asks whether robbery may be committed without sin. Whereas the article about theft started with objections against the morality of this, this article begins with objections in favor of its morality. This suggests that Aquinas is anticipating our question and intends to clarify that the use of violence cannot be condoned. For as he argues, only public authority can rightly exercise violence with one important exception, self-defense. Once again, we wish he would have clarified. Why in the article on robbery does he fail to address directly the urgent manifest need situation? Could I use violence? Could one be acting in self-defense in this situation and so be justified in the use of violence? Or would self-defense only come into play if the woman returning home from Atlanta were to take the pecans, come under attack, and then use violence in response? In which case, everybody is free to use self-defense in a case where one is being attacked. There's nothing special about it. We could get frustrated at Professor Aquinas for not answering our questions, or perhaps we could see this as an invitation to think through these issues for ourselves. It's the mark of a good teacher to leave the student to work some things out. I'm going to follow his example and leave these as open questions. Admittedly, sometimes professors don't answer questions because they're not quite sure they have them, so that may be the case as well. Okay, on to the second case, Jean Valjean. Look at quote, be there. All right, so like I set this one up. The question is, I have somebody else's goods, and can I give those goods to another person, not the owner, out of benevolence? Could that ever be justified? Generally, no. Okay, but, read B, a man may have another's goods. So I have another person's possessions. Either because he has stolen them, or because he has received them on loan or deposit or some other way. In this case, a man ought to pay what he owes rather than benefit his connections out of it, unless perchance the case be so urgent that it would be lawful for him to take another's property in order to relieve the one who is in need. That's an interesting case, right? I have something of yours, I'm going to give it back to you, and then I realize that he's really in need. And it's an urgent manifest case, and so it would be right only in that case to give it to that person. I should also, so Aquinas also defends something similar to this in the article we looked at earlier. Okay, so we get two additions to our principles. In the case of urgent manifest need, God bless you, in which the owner has superabundant goods, one rightly takes what is necessary, openly or secretly, et cetera, by every means necessary, not only for oneself, but also for another. I could also take for another person in that need. And even if one had previously stolen them. Okay, so if I'm reading Aquinas right there, and it's one of those things, it's not exactly clear, but I think what he's saying, he's going further than Jean Valjean. He's saying that imagine a situation where somebody has stolen something, then has a guilty conscience, I better give them back, and in the process of giving them back, subsequent to that, here's somebody in need and says, wait a minute, and decides, rightfully so, that the morally correct action is to give it to the other person rather than to return to the owner. If I'm right, that's surprising, right? That kind of claim. We could call that the case of the repentant thief, okay? So think about that one in the Q&A if you want to try to, you know, ask about it. We could look at that. Okay, response. What's the response? Section 3, this is not stealing. For ownership is private, use is public. You may have noticed the last line of the first quote from Aquinas in the last section, quote 2a, says, nor is this properly speaking theft or robbery. So he's not saying there that there's an exception to the moral norm. He's saying it's not theft or robbery. Well, how could that be? What does he mean by saying that such superabundant property belongs by natural or divine right to the one in need? Answering these questions requires an understanding of Aquinas' account of private property, for he has a very different approach than the one we take in modern society. We think of private property and its justification in terms of individual rights. And by the way, John Locke is the one to read for the classical formulation of this. Whatever I mix my labor with in the state of nature, or whatever an individual chooses to pass on to me or exchange with something of mine, belongs to me absolutely for the sake of my own pursuit of the right to life, liberty, you know, happiness, and so forth. By contrast, Aquinas thinks of private property and its justification in terms of the common good. The good of the community is best met by the division of goods into mine and yours, both because this is conducive to my cultivation of virtue and also because it allows us to live in friendship and charity together. Here's the distinction that Aquinas makes when it comes to private property that helps us to see how much he differs from our own modern standard view. 3a. I answer that two things are competent to man in respect of exterior things. One is the power to procure and dispense them. And in this regard, it is lawful for man to possess property. The second thing that is competent to man with regard to external things is their use. In this respect, man ought to possess external things not as his own but as common, so that to wit, he is ready to communicate them to others in their need. While our modern account and that of Aquinas would find much agreement when it comes to the legal protections afforded to private property, Aquinas' insistence that private property exists for the sake of common use does not easily square with our individual rights approach. In the case of urgent manifest need, the human law protecting private property breaks down, and the natural law that insists that goods be used for the benefit of the community comes into force. John Paul II's insistence on exceptionless moral norms is not violated, for stealing is always morally wrong, even if there are cases where what the human law considers stealing is not in keeping with natural law. All right, fourth section then. I answer that. I answer that there is not a right to steal. There is no exception to that moral norm with this explanation that we offer. We need to look at moral, economic, and political lessons that we can draw from this situation. Morally speaking, we can go even further than saying that one does not steal in this case. Not only does one not steal, but the superabundant property owner who does not give to those in need is the thief. Consider what the Catechism of the Catholic Church has to say, quote 4a. Not to enable the poor to share in our goods is to steal from them and deprive them of life. The goods we possess are not ours, but theirs. The demands of justice must be satisfied first of all. That which is already due in justice is not to be offered as a gift of charity. When we attend to the needs of those in want, we give them what is theirs, not ours. More than performing works of mercy, we are paying a debt of justice. Notice especially that the issue here is not charity, but justice, which suggests that even secular economics and politics need to factor in both the value of those goods to those in need and also what the law must consider when determining who owns what. Okay, economics. When considering the value of goods, economics, as Aquinas understands it, needs to factor in these moral considerations. For example, here's what he says about the case of those benefited by an object beyond its market value. So I receive more benefit from this thing than what the market rate is. Be there. If the one man derive a great advantage by being possessed of the other man's property, that's me, and the seller be not at a loss through being without that thing, the seller ought not to raise the price, because the advantage accruing to the buyer is not due to the seller, but to a circumstance affecting the buyer. Now, no man should sell what is not his, though he may charge for the loss he suffers. So we aren't talking here about whether or not it is just to raise the price of one's goods due to changes in market conditions. That's not the issue. We're also not talking about charging more because of the personal costs involved in running my business, that I had to bring these things to the market, and I had to have to cover my costs for that and support my family. These are generally morally acceptable reasons to raise the price. Instead, the question is whether or not I can charge you more for an item because you are in need. And the answer is a firm no. Applying this to the case of the person in need, perhaps we can say that the owner, being not at a loss through being without that thing, cannot rightly ask for anything in return. I mean, the value to this person, his life, offsets any monetary value of the object. It becomes zero. That may be one way an economist could try to explain the equality of these things. Or if anything is owed in return, it's in the form of gratitude, which is a kind of justice for Aquinas. It's a moral kind of justice, not a legal justice, either by showing appreciation or by, in the future, giving a gift to the one from whom one received. As for politics, as mentioned previously, this case points to the limits of human law. In more general terms, Aquinas speaks of the need for human law to tolerate vice. And this is a great, interesting topic in itself. To what extent can human law tolerate things that are against natural law, much less divine law? Okay, quote C. Human law is unable to forbid all that is contrary to virtue, and it suffices for it to prohibit whatever is destructive of human intercourse, while it treats other matters as though they were lawful, not by approving of them, but by not punishing them. Accordingly, if without employing deceit the seller disposes of his goods for more than their worth, or the buyer obtains them for less than their worth, the law looks upon this as licit, unless the excess be too great, because then even human law demands restitution to be made. On the other hand, the divine law leaves nothing unpunished that is contrary to virtue. Hence, according to the divine law, it is reckoned unlawful if the equality of justice be not observed in buying and selling, and he who has received more than he ought must make compensation to him that has suffered loss if the loss be considerable. Okay, so you see the distinction there that divine law demands justice to be observed. And if you have followed the human law, but it's against God's law, then you are still acting unjustly and you will be asked to give an account of this, not before the human judge, but before the divine. So this quote about the need for human law to tolerate a certain level of injustice for the sake of the common good implies that the pendulum of injustice swings in two directions. On the one hand, the greedy miser who unjustly holds onto the goods that in truth belong to the needy will not be required by law to forfeit them. On the other hand, the moocher who lives off others' largesse will not only not be punished, but will receive what really belongs to others who are more needy and deserving from the hands of the just and charitable members of society who intend to help him, the freeloader. He's going to get away with this to a certain extent. The attempt to eradicate such injustices will do more harm than good, for the wheat and chaff are mixed together in this world, and only in the last judgment can they be separated. Before considering ways in which human law can attempt to find a middle ground between punishing every act of stealing on the one hand and failing to protect private property on the other, Robin Hood. It's a commonplace in many cultures to lionize the outlaw hero. Generally, this fellow is an outcast from society due to some injustice committed against him personally. And this injustice is a reflection of the gross inequality between the haves and have-nots. As a result, we, the have-nots, are asked to root for him, especially in his role of robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. In the U.S., we have Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Pretty Boy Floyd, all of whom are real personages whose lives have been mythologized. Today, perhaps the most well-known fictional character is, who would you say? The Joker. That's who I would say. So the Joker movies seem to me trying to kind of make this case that it's the system that's broken, right? He's working social services, and it's the system that's broken. So it's, you know, we could greatly sympathize with him and maybe even think that they have it coming, these people. Okay, so all right. Whatever, you come with your own example. All right, let me make clear that Aquinas' principles of private property do not justify their actions, the Joker, or, you know, Billy the Kid, and so forth. And that these are just bad men with a warped moral code. Generally, these so-called heroes take from the rich, and yes, on occasion, they give to the poor, but they do not take from the rich in order to do so. And Pretty Boy Floyd, who was from Georgia, actually, and a lot of his actions were in Oklahoma, this is really clear, this is not why he was doing it, though he would help poor people. Arla Guthrie wrote a song that's famous about this during with the Depression. To take their side is to reject law and order in the name of an individualistic philosophy found in both liberal and conservative versions. They could find both sides of that in any society. One of its proponents, Thoreau, sums up this cancerous philosophy nicely, and he agrees with it. It is not desirable to cultivate a respect for the law so much as for the right. While we can sympathize with the outlaw hero's plight, we can join him in criticizing the injustices of our society, and we can even reduce his prison sentence so long as he does not present a danger. We cannot condone his lawless actions nor cave to the demand to radically remake society to suit his vision of heaven on earth. That being said, let me just point out that Robin Hood, at least of mythology, is an interesting exception. He is acting as a loyal subject of the true king, Richard the Lionheart, against Prince John's usurpation of the throne. Robin Hood, then, is in a unique case, since he acts in the name of restoring law and order rather than replacing law with so-called right. Marcus Aurelius, the Gladiator movie, right, that you know, Russell Crowe's character is acting in the name of the legitimate emperor there. So there's another example. Let us now look at ways in which law and order can be maintained, but also acknowledge the exceptional cases in which private property breaks down. And these are really interesting cases, whether or not you're going to be a lawyer, if you're ever going to own anything, or want to be involved in community development efforts in some sort, these are worth thinking about. Okay, recall that our initial examples, the woman returning home from Atlanta, Jean Valjean, Robin Hood, required also asking a political question. Can or should the law permit stealing in certain cases? We now see that while stealing is always morally wrong, in case of urgent and manifest necessity, property ownership naturally changes hands, such that the needy becomes the rightful user or distributor. Can such hard cases be accounted for in the law? Well, hard cases make bad laws, so we should proceed with caution. But I do have in mind four ways in which the law can make an attempt to address them, though it will require broadening our definition of urgent and manifest, which brings new concerns. So first, Jean Valjean laws. Second, laws, policy might be a better term, establishing provisions for the destitute. Third, adverse possession laws. And fourth, eminent domain. Okay, so I'm making up a term. There's no such thing as Jean Valjean laws, to my knowledge. Maybe there is, but I'm not aware of any. And we might want to avoid a French name for an American law. We want to come up with our own name for that, right? We could think of the standard American trope of the pie on the windowsill. Is this a familiar image to you, pie on the windowsill? Okay, all right, good. So I'll explain it anyway. I don't know how familiar this is to you, but the cartoons that raised me and gave me my moral formation and taught me about the world outside gave me this idea that moms and grandmas all across this great country of ours baked pies every day, left them on the windowsill to cool, and on a regular basis would return to find that some good-natured, starving hobo had taken their pie, perhaps leaving a quarter, two bits, a thank you note, or a poem as payment. I always wondered why these matrons didn't wise up and leave those pies to cool in a more protected environment, like my mom did. But I suppose they baked so many that they just saw this as part of their care for the needy, the hobo coming through. My mom was not under that obligation because we lived in the suburbs. And, we had plenty of pies. Nobody needed to give them away. Okay, so if we were to establish pie on the windowsill laws, allowing the needy to rightfully take in cases of urgent manifest need, we would have to look for analogous situations for a frame of reference. And an opposite kind of law, which is interesting to think about, is laws that allow you to leave a baby at a hospital without consequence, right? So rather than the baby dying, of course. Okay, so an example that might be more appropriate, though, would be Good Samaritan laws. These protect people who come to the aid of the needy from being sued if they unintentionally harm them. For example, let's imagine you see somebody trapped in a car and you think it's going to catch on fire. And in the process of pulling this person out of the fire, you injure him. He can't sue you. It would seem we could frame a similar law that is narrow enough to only apply to the urgent manifest necessity case. Yet there are legitimate concerns that such laws would undermine private property claims to a sufficient degree that it might be best to find other ways to care for the needy. You can think of so many ways in which people could abuse these kinds of laws. Okay, in the other ways that I think are better, provisions for the destitute, adverse possession, eminent domain, what's interesting is that the arguments in their favor, at least to some extent, rest on concern, not for your good or my good, but the common good. Now, we generally think of provision for the destitute in terms of rights. We like to argue that all people have a right to basic goods and services, and the government then is obligated to provide them. For various reasons, I want to avoid speaking in terms of rights. I want to instead speak about the common good. Since it's so difficult to establish a law allowing for taking in the case of manifest and urgent need, and the protection of private property is such an important concern, not only for the haves, but also for the have-nots who ought to receive from their largesse, it's better to establish provision for the destitute, if necessary, paid for out of public funds. Admittedly, this means raising taxes and also expanding what counts as urgent manifest necessity. For policies and laws will have to err on the side of requiring assistance for a wider variety of reasons. This approach does have the advantage of reducing drastically the number of situations in which someone could claim that he acted morally when taking another's property, because there are other options available for that person, and it is publicly made known what you should do if you're in that situation. Let me also be clear that it would be best if the destitute were cared for by the virtuous members of society, individually and collectively, and above all, as organized by the church. So the government should ensure that any efforts it makes are auxiliary to, or at least not harmful to, this social way of providing for the destitute. All right, the second way, adverse possession laws. These refer to situations which somebody can establish ownership of another's property by maintaining it, often with the proviso that said possession is open and notorious, that's the technical term in the law, or visible and evident to members of the community. So think of things like, we're neighbors and it's not really clear where the border is, and I mow it for a long period of time, and then we get the deed out, and it turns out that was your property. That's one example. Squatting, though, is the one that I think is the more an interesting situation. where somebody has taken up residence on someone else's property. That might not seem as obvious to be a case of urgent manifest necessity, but you know, we could imagine people who literally end up, actually in our community, there was someone kicked out of his house by his wife, and he ends up camping in the monastery's property for a period of time. You know, I would assume the monks felt bad for him and were like, you know, that's fine as long as he's not, you know, doing anything problematic there, he can stay. And human law generally has to distinguish in these situations between real property, lands and structures, and personal property, movable goods, as well as between good faith and bad faith adverse possession. On the shorter end, Mexico only requires 5 years of good faith adverse possession of real property in order to establish ownership. On the long end, Canada requires 60 years for crown lands. You know, if the king were to, I don't know what a crown land is exactly, but you know that these are lands that are of a special protection in Canada and other parts of the Commonwealth, and then only 10 years if it's a private citizen. In the US, California and Montana require only 5 years, Louisiana and New Jersey, 30. And for your information, in Georgia is 20, but it's only 7 years if accompanied by color of title. For example, if you made tax payments on the adversely possessed property. I would guess this comes in when there's like a barn or some structure that's on an area that technically is your neighbor's and you've been maintaining it and paying on it, utilities and so forth. And eventually then, you know, you've been doing it openly. You're not hiding this from anybody. You know, it becomes yours after only 7 years. While such laws broaden urgent manifest needs considerably, they do so in a way that acknowledges Aquinas' principle that private property is for the sake of the common good. Those who use a property to benefit themselves and in full view of the public ought to own it. Anybody who lives near blighted properties, like I do, knows the harms they bring to the community and that their absentee owners fail to observe the principle that ownership is for the sake of use. This is a common thing. You know, somebody inherits grandma's property, lives in Florida and in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. They're never planning on visiting it and just let it go derelict. And it becomes not only a blight to the community, but something that would attract drug use and so forth. So we want to have ways of addressing those kinds of situations. Finally, eminent domain. This provides a way in which the government can override private property claims in the name of the common good. While Aquinas does not directly take up this issue, he does tell us that, quote, it is no robbery if princes exact from their subjects that which is due to them for the safeguarding of the common good, even if they use violence in so doing, end quote. Once again, we can see how such laws expand urgent and manifest need. It's difficult to frame the law so the government invokes this power only in extremely exceptional circumstances. Generally, eminent domain is used in the building of roads and railways or utilities, but can also function like adverse possession laws for the sake of rebuilding blighted properties. If you're interested in thinking through the limits of this authority, it's worth reading the 2005 U.S. Supreme Court case, Kalo versus City of New London. Five judges found in favor of the city government taking a private owner's real property and giving it to another private owner because that owner had a redevelopment plan for it. Seems pretty extreme, right? I have a better use of your property that will benefit the city, will create jobs, will increase tax revenue, and it will revitalize this blighted section of the city. It's not hard to see how such a broad justification for eminent domain could unduly undermine private property. But that does not negate the fact that it is legitimate in principle for public authority to foster the good use of even private property. So just in order for me to get to Georgia, which we do twice a year to come down with the family to the family farm, the number of times you have to drive around somebody's house on these highways, because the way that they that guy's house was there, and they, rather than say, hey, we're going to declare, you know, and now it's a blighted property 50 years later. I mean, you know, I think there are cases where you say, maybe there is a public good here that overrides a property that's gone derelict, and we're going to build a straight road rather than have to build around everything. Okay, and you might disagree with that, but you can see that there's going to be some cases like utilities. Let me wrap up by saying that we have seen how taking in the case of necessity, even if morally justifiable in extreme circumstances, is very difficult to address in political life. On the one hand, allowing it opens the door to the wiles of the moocher and the power-mongering of despotic governments. On the other hand, forbidding it outright leads us to lock up Jean Valjean and the woman returning home to Atlanta. But unless you're going to be a lawyer or politician, or again, get involved in urban development and redesign and so forth, the real issue is probably for most of us a moral one, not a legal one. If you have property in your possession that you neglect, you act wrongly in withholding its use from others. So remember that quote in the beginning, mentally go to your closet right now. Mentally go to some place where you say, yeah, I got stuff in there that I'm kind of wondering if I should be giving it away. If others go without, such that through no fault of their own, they can rightly take your superabundant property, you must ask yourself whether you have contributed to this by your failure to use what has been entrusted to you for their good. Loving our neighbor as ourself demands that we take Jesus seriously when he tells us that at the end of our lives, the king will ask us to give an account of how we have used our time, talent, and worldly goods, and tell us, what you did to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did to me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.